Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court completed its term with an announcement in a case with perhaps major ramifications for the state of Oklahoma. In a 5-4 decision, the high court held in McGirt versus Oklahoma that because Congress had not expressly disestablished the Muscogee Creek Reservation here in eastern Oklahoma, that reservation still exists when it comes to the Federal Major Crimes Act, which means that major crimes alleged to be committed by an American Indian within the borders of the reservation should be tried in federal court, not state court. Currently, the state only cedes jurisdiction on crimes committed on lands actually owned by the tribe. In plain language, Justice Neil Gorsuch, writing for the court's majority, stated that the United States, in a series of treaties and statutes, had solemnly guaranteed the land forever set apart as a home for the said Creek Nation, and that while Congress has since broken more than a few of its promises to the tribe, it lays to Congress alone to terminate the reservation. And since it has not done so, in essence, the reservation still exists. Joining me to discuss the implications of this decision for the state of Oklahoma and the other five nations that share similar stories to the Creeks is Isla Haas, an assistant professor of law at the University of Tulsa College of Law and the Native American Law Center at the law school. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Isla Haas, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. Glad to be here.
Yeah, in McGirt versus Oklahoma, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision yesterday held that because Congress never directly disestablished the Muscogee Creek Reservation in eastern Oklahoma, that reservation still exists. I think that's the essence of the decision. What are the immediate implications of this decision?
Well, the decision itself, Justice Gorsuch writing for the majority, is actually quite narrow and quite specific. It specifically says that for the purposes of criminal jurisdiction under the Federal Major Crimes Act, that the Creek Reservation has not been diminished or disestablished. It does not say that it's going to necessarily apply to other federal criminal jurisdictional schemes that might apply in Indian country, nor does it necessarily explicitly say that it would apply to other reservation lands for other tribes in the state. However, given the language of the opinion and also given so many of the similarities in terms of treaty language that exists between the Creek Nations treaties vis-a-vis some of the other tribal treaties in eastern Oklahoma, there absolutely are implications in terms of criminal jurisdiction under the Major Crimes Act and beyond the Major Crimes Act in other parts of what's now Oklahoma.
I think everyone is assuming this will also apply to the Cherokee, Chickasaw, Chickasaw, and Seminole lands. Do you think that will be the case?
Yes, I do.
What about other tribal lands in the state, like thinking of the Sac and Fox, Kickapoo, Quapaw, Eastern Shawnee, just to name a few. And there's some out west as well. Have those reservations been disestablished, or could it apply there as well?
Well, yeah, I want to be clear in that the actual opinion explicitly only applies to the Creek Nation. And this is why things get a little tricky when we think about our judiciary system, our judiciary branch, and how case law works. So there is an opinion that just came out yesterday that applies under one federal statute, under one treaty or a series of treaties for one tribal nation. And it is up to lawyers as the tribe, state, federal government, for scholars, for advocates, for community members, then to try to figure out what the scope of that and implications of that opinion can be. And that's how case law works, is that folks will look at one judicial opinion and then try to figure out how it might be applied in other contexts. So it could be that, and as I understand it, is the case that the other five nations have already been in communication with federal law enforcement and the state about transitioning criminal jurisdiction under the Major Crimes Act on their reservation land to the federal government. Now, that might not have been said explicitly in the judicial opinion, but it's reading the writing on the wall and also trying to prevent future litigation. So when we think about potential arguments for reservation lands as established by treaties in other parts of Oklahoma or, frankly, anywhere in the country, it really is going to be dependent on the language that's used in the treaty, what language was used in potential subsequent congressional statutes, and some other factors. But the most important consideration that was highlighted in the opinion that came out yesterday, and is consistent with other federal case law regarding the diminishment or disestablishment of a reservation, is whether Congress explicitly disestablished that reservation. And as we saw in the case yesterday, they did not do that explicitly with the Creek Nation. And I think there are many other tribal treaties that could be agreements that was not the case either.
So let's get into that. The idea that allotment, which happened in the late 19th century, where Indian lands were divided up among tribal members and then eventually given to other people as well, or being able to land runs, for example, in the state. That does not diminish the fact that the reservation still exists from this decision.
That's absolutely correct. And again, consistent with principles that were established in other federal cases, that only Congress can diminish or disestablish a reservation. They can do it. They have to do it explicitly. So the state of Oklahoma and McGirt had said, we've had allotment here, and a lot of these parcels of land are now owned by non-Indians. And so the makeup of the community and the demographic of the community has changed. And the court said very firmly that allotment alone and changes in demographics of a community alone will not disestablish a reservation. And again, Congress is the one that can do that, and they can do that explicitly. Those other kinds of factors in terms of changing of the demographics of the community may only come into play in really limited circumstances when Congress has spoken, but ambiguously, to potential diminishment of a reservation. And that was the case in the 1966 treaty with between the Creek and the United States, and again, would not necessarily be the case in many other treaties.
Now, the four-vote minority, which included Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Alito, and Justice Thomas, felt that allotment and all of the things Congress had done to Indian country in the last 140 years pretty much negates the reservation. That view was rejected. In fact, I think Justice Thomas said the court had no jurisdiction in this particular case, but that was their view, correct?
That was their view, and as an Indian law scholar, I would argue that is the mistaken view. Justice Gorsuch is a textualist, and it is very clear in our federal law that Congress is the only entity that can diminish or disestablish a reservation. And so this argument that changes in makeup or other congressional actions that potentially limit the tribal authority on certain areas is going to necessarily change the reservation, that's comparing two things. Yes, the federal government and Congress have repeatedly, horrifically enacted legislations and policies that have compromised tribal ability to exercise authority that they have had since time immemorial. But again, if Congress hasn't spoken directly to disestablishment or diminishment of a reservation, then the reservation is not diminished or disestablished.
So you mentioned that this decision was narrow and specific to the Federal Major Crimes Act, and how this existed prior to this decision was that the Federal Major Crimes Act applied to American Indian defendants on tribal-owned land as opposed to tribal-recognized land. Is that the case?
State of Oklahoma did not view these lands as tribal reservations and to be considered Indian country. And so they were prosecuting and convicting defendants on the basis that this land is not tribal land. That's
it correct. Wasn't owned by the tribe. Now, with this decision, at least today in the Muscogee Creek Nation, all lands within their boundaries, if an American Indian defendant is accused of a crime, it'll have to be in federal court? Will it be federal court or tribal court, or exactly what do we know?
Well, it's going to depend, and there could be instances of concurrent jurisdiction. But when we're talking again about major crimes where the defendant is an Indian and whether the accused victim is either a non-Indian or an Indian, that would fall under federal jurisdiction. Now, tribes maintain concurrent jurisdiction. Again, we're instances where the defendant is an Indian and the accused victim is either Indian or non-Indian. And again, when the locus of the crime is in Indian country. So yes, that would be federal prosecution with the potential of tribal concurrent jurisdiction, which the Supreme Court has held is because there are two separate sovereigns that both the tribe and the federal government could have a criminal jurisdictional authority. Now, in practice, what we're likely to see is that most of these cases are going to get tried by the federal government, and it's really going to be up to the tribes to determine whether they also want to have some sort of concurrent jurisdiction and prosecution for these crimes.
So how is this likely to affect McGirt's case, Murphy's case, which is also a case that was attached to this case, and others right. that involve an alleged crime on reservation land with an American Indian defendant? Do you expect that most of these cases, if it's a major crime, it'll be done in some sort of federal court?
That's exactly right. So they would be done in federal court, I think, for the individual defendant with defendants. With cases that are pending, it will be transitioning them potentially to federal custody and having a federal trial, so a new trial. And I think that's really an important distinction. This is contrary to some of the hyperbole that's going on in the clickbait headlines. It is not about not administering criminal jurisdiction against crime. It's about ensuring the proper venue is being used in order to prosecute those crimes.
Now, how big a change will this be for the state of Oklahoma? And let's compare it to maybe some other states. I hear the Washington state is often used as a precedent where you have tribal land that is changed greatly, but there are still federal magistrates that deal with these cases, and they just have a bigger federal presence in a lot of these criminal cases. What are the precedences for how Oklahoma will have to change?
This is done all the time in Indian country, where the federal government has jurisdiction under the Major Crimes Act or other federal statutes, and they are, instead of the state, are prosecuting crimes and trying these crimes instead of the state. So if I look at it from the point of view of the state of Oklahoma, they're going to have less cases. Now, the transition might be a little, it takes some labor and some work, but it's certainly not impossible. And again, this is literally what federal law enforcement does. They are, are responsible for throwing and enforcing crime in Indian country with their tribal partners. And so this happens every single day. Now, potentially because of the large land base that we've got here, it might mean having a shift in where resources are head away from the state and more towards tribe and federal law enforcement, so that they can, if there's going to be a substantial increase in terms of the number of cases that are going to have to prosecute. But again, this kind of thing happens all the time, and courts and law enforcement should be able to transition their cases and their dockets so that they can manage an increased caseload.
My guest today is Isla Haas. She's an assistant professor of law at the University of Tulsa College of Law and the Native American Law Center. We're discussing the implications of the Supreme Court's decision yesterday in the McGirt and Murphy cases involving the state of Oklahoma, which was involved in a American Indian defendant who was tried in state court for an alleged crime that occurred on Muscogee Creek land. And the court held that, in fact, that should take place in federal court, that the state does not have jurisdiction. Let's talk about the backlog of cases. Now, when Murphy was going to the high court, the state talked mm-hmm. about the tremendous number of people who have been convicted in state court that would be clogging the federal courts, and that it would just create chaos in the system. I think they sort of underplayed that when McGirt came to the high court. Do we know exactly how many convicted Indian defendants could be eligible for retrial under this decision?
Well, thanks to Native journalist Rebecca Nagel, a Native professor and researcher, Desi Rodriguez-Lombert, they actually dug into some of this data in a piece from The Atlantic not too long ago. And they were calling the state of Oklahoma's bluff that there is, over 1,000, potentially 2,000 cases that could be impacted here. And they found that we were really talking about, potentially a couple of hundred, dozens of potential cases that might qualify for a new trial under federal courts. So again, yes, it's going to be a lot of work and a lot of navigation, but certainly not to completely disrupt the entire workings of the criminal system.
There's an article in the Tulsa World today from a local attorney discussing, what a defendant is likely to do in a situation like that. It's in many cases, he said it's likened to rolling the dice because you might actually get a worse penalty in federal court.
That is a really important point. So there's been so much media and discussion around what the implications these are going to be for the state of Oklahoma, for non-Indian citizens living within now the boundaries or within the boundaries that have existed of Creek Reservation. But what about the Indian defendant? So, you know, there are some that say that federal prosecution can be, less favorable to defendants because of a sentencing guidelines, because of less flexibility of federal prosecutors to negotiate. And that is something that is really worth thinking about in terms of, is it worth the time and effort to retry a case and then be subject to harsher penalties? But again, that is, you know, at least allowing for a reset and a start over, which could be a great opportunity too.
And for these defendants that find themselves in this situation, the clock is running, right? Because the federal appeals process on something like this is, I think, what is it, about a year? You have about a year?
That's right.
Yeah, so it's actually far more strict than probably state court.
That's exactly right. So there is a lot on the line for these defendants. And so what they're having to navigate is really important and should be even definitely part of some of the dialogue that we're having.
Well, let's take a step back and let's look at the history of these series of cases, which, again, as I mentioned, actually started with a case called Sharp versus Murphy. It's sort of interesting to know that this has not been settled law. Here it is, 2020, and, you know, this is going back to decisions taken right after the Civil War, and yeah. Then allotment was in the 1880s, I think. So we're talking 130, 40 years, and this is still not settled till this day of what the Muscogee Creek Reservation was and is, potentially the other five nations here in the state.
Yeah. You know, what you're raising is one of the issues and challenges of case law going through the appellate process of litigation. And even if an act is illegal, that sometimes, a lot of times, you're going to have to take it to court and actually have someone say that an action is or is not illegal. And again, that process can take decades, if not hundreds of years. But this is also speaking to some of the challenges with federal Indian law. And I would argue, despite many inconsistencies and ambiguities and just frustrations in terms of how different courts and then the same courts might handle issues relating to jurisdictional conflicts between tribe, state, and the federal government, it is not surprising to me in the climate, anti-tribe and anti-Indian racism that is pervasive within many of our institutions, that we are continuously seeing various governments, whether state or local governments, that are continuously trying to subvert tribal sovereignty by challenging their jurisdiction or, frankly, ignoring their criminal jurisdiction at the detriment to the tribes. And so, I would argue this is pretty settled law in terms of we know in what instances the federal government versus state government would have jurisdiction for a major crime involving an Indian defendant when the locus of the crime is an Indian country. But that doesn't mean that a state or local government is going to follow that. And so I really am hopeful that in the current political climate that we are in, after the tragic deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and then so many other Black, Brown, Native people, there's an appetite to talk about institutional racism, modern-day colonization, and so that hopefully we'll see less infringement by neighboring state and local governments on tribal sovereignty, so it doesn't have to go to the Supreme Court. Because think of what incredible investment this has to be for a tribe every single time another government infringes on their rights. So this is, again, we don't even have, these tribes weren't even part of the case, right? We're talking about a defendant against the state. And so for every tribe that has to make an appearance, submit a front of the court brief, because their sovereignty could be implicated for every time they might have to challenge state or local infringement. That is a huge investment, not only in money and time, but frankly, energy that they could be devoting to other areas of their government. And that other governments within the American family governments, like state and local governments, don't have to deal with, because they don't have folks trying to deny statehood exists.
And I still find it amazing that this is not overturning a precedent at the Supreme Court. This is the first time this issue has got to the Supreme Court, of whether these reservations, which were, you know, put in place in the 1830s, with statehood in 1907, this is the first time it's ever reached the Supreme Court. So this is not overturning a Supreme Court case. This is the first time it's ever got to the Supreme Court to determine.
Yeah. And this is, again, a really good example of day-to-day practice and how often that becomes the law on the ground, even if it's not necessarily the law on the books. Yeah. And again, also, when we think about, so much of this has to start with someone initiating what will end up being a very long litigation in order to get challenge some of these principles that folks look at as law.
Let's talk about the decision-making of the court. As you mentioned earlier, Gorsuch joined the liberal wing in creating this 5-4 majority. He wrote the decision. It's interesting, he also wrote the decision on the Title VII LGBT decision this term. He's got this textualist view, but he also has a libertarian view. Were you surprised he voted this way and wrote the opinion? I know he recused himself when Sharp versus Murphy came to the court last year, which is the same issue but a different case, because he participated in the Tenth Circuit deliberations. So that ended with a 4-4 tie. I suppose McGirt was the decision he could weigh in on.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I'll say, unlike many of my other colleagues that spend their entire careers studying and thinking about these individual justices, I'm not particularly great at assessing and predicting, nor do I try to. I will say, leading up to Gorsuch's confirmation, there had been several tribes and other activists and scholars that were supportive of his appointment to the Supreme Court because of his existing history on trying and hearing cases related to tribes. And unfortunately, so many of our federal judges and justices aren't coming in with that kind of practical experience. And so I am not surprised that Gorsuch has wanted to take a role in terms of considering Indian law cases. And I'm pleasantly surprised, but not shocked at the kind of language that he used within the opinion. We have seen other Supreme Court cases, in my opinion, being really dry in terms of the letter of the law that might be before the court, or really focusing on the language of the congressional statutes, as they should. But Gorsuch did write an opinion that really highlighted and reinforced the long history and continued history of state and local government not honoring tribal sovereignty and jurisdiction.
You know, as a non-lawyer, a lot of times when you read Supreme Court decisions, it's really hard to make sense of it. But having looked at the decision, there was a lot of the language where I completely understood what he was trying to say. He was saying it in pretty much plain language. That Congress didn't disestablish the reservation, so it still exists.
That's exactly right. And he also honored and acknowledged the long history of colonization that was been legalized by federal law in this country, acknowledged the Trail of Tears and other genocide. And I think he didn't use that language. That's my language. But he acknowledged that plight. And I think that is incredibly important in terms of getting credibility with communities and advocates that want to continue to support and protect tribal sovereignty. And I think it also adds a story that many Americans, many attorneys, many scholars aren't going to have that context without that history. And so I think a lot of folks are often shocked when they start working in Indian country how much emphasis and dialogue is put on, you know, old treaties and old relationships and documents. Well, that history is very near, has modern-day implications and modern-day applications. And so I think that was really important. But that being said, I would also say, again, someone situated where I am, that I would have loved to have seen the state of Oklahoma get their hands slapped a little bit. Because the case did not have to go all the way to the Supreme Court. They could have withdrawn at any point, worked with the tribes to come to an agreement in advance of this decision. And they chose to push this and make arguments that, again, I would argue are anti-tribe and anti-Indian racism.
Yeah. Well, very quickly in our last couple of minutes, you mentioned that this decision was very narrow, very specific to the Federal Major Crimes Act involving the Muscogee Creek Reservation. But are there other issues this decision could influence in its own decision-making as other issues of Indian sovereignty make its way through the federal court system?
Sure. So we had already talked about, I think this is excellent precedent and should be used by the four other tribes in eastern Oklahoma to, as they are working with the state of Oklahoma and federal partners to transition these cases. Again, given the language of other treaties and the language of the judicial opinion, I think it could also be said that, again, given the language of the opinion, that it should really could also be applied to other federal criminal statutes implicating Indian country, not just the Major Crimes Act. Now, some of the pushback that you saw in the dissent and you've seen from some businesses have been about, you know, what are the implications for civil and regulatory jurisdiction. And now, again, this case is very specific. I do not believe that any kind of big shift in civil jurisdiction would go unlitigated. And so it is to be seen whether there are going to be other arguments for tribal civil and regulatory jurisdiction within the outer boundaries of the reservation. Now, in general, there's very little instances in which the tribe will be able to extend civil jurisdiction, but I absolutely think that the argument could potentially be expanded, especially if there's better understanding and appetite in the federal courts to be able to recognize what is already existing in terms of the right of tribes to protect their community when it's within the boundaries of their land. Okay. But that being said, I don't want to conflate that with what's actually going to be happening in the near future. And I just don't think that's particularly realistic. You know, could be something down the line, but I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow.
All right. We have to leave it there. Isla Haas, Okay. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich. It was nice talking with you.
Isla Haas is an assistant professor of law at the University of Tulsa College of Law and their Native American Law Center. She joined us today to discuss the implications of the Supreme Court's decision in the McGirt versus Oklahoma decision announced yesterday at the Supreme Court. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.